Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we have author Lillian Cernica. Is that the right way to say your name?
Cernica.
She's going to talk about her book, The Writer's Spellbook. Welcome, Lillian.
Thank you. Good to be here, Sherry.
Please tell your audience a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I've been a professional writer since 1993, and I write historical romance. I write short stories in various genres, fantasy, science fiction, historical. I write nonfiction as well. The Writer's Spellbook is a good example. I also have The Fright Factory out now, which is about how to write horror. My regular nonfiction gig is writing the reviews of horror short fiction for Tangent online. So I like to be a little bit of everything because it keeps things interesting.
Yeah, I know how to be. I'm in that same boat. It's weird how you fall into one thing and then you get an idea and you fall into another, and it's sort of like a turntable. You can't get off because you got on it by yourself and now you can't get off.
True.
Are you a big reader? Do you have a favorite book? And does that ignite your imagination for when you start writing your fiction?
Yes, yes, and yes. When I moved to the house that I live in now about a year and a half ago, I had to compress from having an office and having half the master bedroom. So now I'm in my office with a bed in it, so to speak, and I have these boxes because I don't have enough bookshelves right now. I love books. I have recently gotten the hang of e-book reading because I have progressive trifocal glasses. I have to take them on. You know, put them on, take them off, put them on, take them off. But free e-books are a lot of fun. My favorite book. I'm sorry?
Yeah, I've just discovered it myself.
If I had to pick one book out of the thousands that I've read that would be my favorite that I could read over and over and over again, Now, this is probably predictable answer, but Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice is a good one.
All right, mine too.
Ah, cool.
Yeah, I love her writing. I love all of her books, but yeah, Pride and Prejudice, you can't help but make that your fave.
Yeah, my number two favorite's Persuasion.
Yep.
You don't hear a lot about that one, but I love the storyline.
Oh, I just love Anne. One of my favorite books. So when did you start reading? Were you, I know you probably started as a little girl, but did your dad and mom read to you as a child and you kind of like took over the stories, or did you get into it like a little bit later? When did you start reading?
Well, my mother did read to me, you know, bedtime stories and whatnot. I can remember when I was probably a toddler, looking at the books on the bookshelves and wanting to grab one and get into it. We have a joke in the family that I reached for a dictionary or something and it hit me on the head, and that's why I'm a writer. But my first love was fairy tales, like the Golden Books fairy tales. I still have my copy of it from when I was 4 years old, I think. When I started really getting into it was probably grade school. I remember my grandmother saying, "Why do you always have your nose in a book?" And I said to her, "Because what's in the book is more fun than what's out here."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
And you could go anywhere. People who say they don't read don't realize reading isn't boring. Reading is transportation to anywhere, in any job, in any place you want to go.
Absolutely. It's a time machine.
Yep, which is part of my fascination for time travel, I think, because I've always been a reader. as Doctor Who says, timey-wimey.
Wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey, yes.
I love that explanation.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of time travel, are you a big history buff? And does that also, you said you're into historical novels, so that must take place of one of your top priorities in when what you're reading.
Well, yeah, in my novels, that's where I like to go, because to write historical fiction, you need a big canvas, because of all the details and the locations and whatnot, right? I've written historical short fiction and sold it, but it's more fun to have a lot of room to work. The first historical I published is Ship of Dreams, and that's in 1725 in the Caribbean, which is the golden age of piracy. And the book that I am in the process of completing right now is set in Japan in 1865, 3 years before the shogunate falls and the emperor takes over again. So that's an exciting time period because everything's in flux.
Cool. And when you are working on a book or a story, are you also reading for pleasure?
It depends. Sometimes I have to read something completely different than what I'm working on, because I don't want things to bleed over, you know. Other times, yeah, I try to stick to the same genre so I stay in the groove. It depends on the thing that I'm writing and where I'm at in the process.
Yeah, that's true. I've always been a big mystery nut, but I haven't yet written a book that's a mystery book. And so I'm always reading one of my favorite mysteries while I'm writing. That's like, I'm a big Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers person. So really, I read that more when I'm writing. When I'm not writing, I read practically anything I can grab my hands on to. do you have a favorite genre that you just love, that's your go-to for just get your stress out?
You know, it's funny. It sounds like you and I are twins, because mysteries, I love mysteries. I like what I guess might be called woman in danger books, too. Janet Ivanovich's Stephanie Plum series is a lot of fun. That's like brain candy for me. I just discovered Jana De Leon's Miss Fortune series, and that's too silly. The Sinful Ladies Society of Sinful Louisiana, oh, my God, they're so much fun.
Ever read Mrs.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to ask, did you ever read Mrs. Bradley, the Mrs. Bradley books?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, my God. It is so cool. It's set in the 1920s, and she's this old, sort of an old crabby lady, but she's really also ahead of her time, and she solves murder mysteries. The BBC actually did, I always get it. This is the way I start. People say TV doesn't help you read. For me, that's never been true. If I see a good TV show that has a book series, I have to buy the book, and then I devour it.
No, I know what you mean. I've seen that show on Netflix with Diana Rigg.
That's it.
Yeah, I've been
meaning to
watch that.
The books are very different, though. She's much more beautiful. She's gorgeous, and the lady that's described in the book is an old grown.
Yeah, Diana Rigg can wear anything. I mean.
Oh yeah.
But I'll have to make a note of that, because I'm always looking for recommendations what to read.
Oh, I love the books, even though they're really different from the series. That's okay with me, because I'm used to that. But. I mean, it goes back to when I was a child. The Ellery Queen TV series with Jim Hutton.
Oh, I remember that.
I love that show. And that's what got me into Ellery Queen and Mysteries.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, they at BBC started doing Miss Marple, the first Miss Marple series, which got me into Agatha Christie, and then... the first Lord Peter series, I got into Dorothy Sayers. Actually, Dorothy Sayers, I didn't start reading until I was in college, which is a good thing, because she is the most She's fascinating, but she is the most difficult to read mystery writer. You have to actually use every part of your brain to read her books.
Yeah, she is pretty dense that way, dense reading, and
yeah.
That can be a bit of a strain.
Yeah. And it's really, even though they're light and they're fun, there's a depth to them that you really have to have some level of education in order to, I mean, the lady had her hero propose to the heroine in Latin.
Yeah,
who does
that? Really? Well, at least we know we can conjugate RRR.
And they throw French phrases, and there's no translation. So you have to, like, when I first started reading her, because it was recommended by Agatha Christie, actually, when I read her autobiography, so
mm-hmm.
I had to start reading it. And, I mean, she doesn't translate. You know, Agatha, she'll say something in French, and then Perrault will explain it. But she doesn't translate. All these people are talking all these different languages, Italian, French, Latin, ancient Latin, and nobody says it. You have to look it up, and it's hard.
No, I understand completely because I'm a big fan of ghost stories. I collect ghost story anthologies from the turn of the century. And in M.R. James' stories, you know, he was a classic scholar. He assumes that the people who read his work are men of his similar education, and so they're going to know what he's saying. And it's like you say, I have to look up the Latin all the time.
Because they don't put translation.
Mm-mm.
There's nothing. You're like, oh, my God. Like, I actually refused to buy a book, Latin book, but I went to the Remember bookstores. And I took the book on Latin to English to look up what he said and then put it back on the shelf. I'd like you to give the audience a little taste of your book, not a reading, just explaining what the actual storyline is about and what you like the readers to take away from it.
Oh, the writer's spell book?
Yes.
Okay, the writer's spell book is a good book for contemplating all the questions, all the different directions from which you can approach how your magic works in your story. Because it's so multifaceted, you can come in one place and find yourself in another very quickly because of the questions that develop. For years, I kept seeing in writer's guidelines for fantasy, editors asking for consistent, plausible magic systems. So I thought, you know, apparently there's a demand for this kind of thing because writers may or may not be providing it. So I decided to come up with a manual. And I lecture on this a lot at conventions, and we generally have a good time talking about it. Because there's gamers are so much a part of the writing population now, too, and vice versa, that creating magic systems in gaming is wide. So that's another reason I created the Writer's Spellbook, because the audience is there as well.
It's really cool. And do you find that people that have read it come back to you to, like, email you or see you at a convention and start question? You just came out with the book, so they can't come to conventions yet. But do they email you and say, okay, I get this, but how do I get it to fit into my storyline? I mean, do you get questions like that?
Yeah, I do get people coming up to me at conventions in the Bay Area here, because I do a lot of the local cons, and they'll say to me, this works, but what happens if I want to do this? And those questions could get very complicated. So we usually go hang out in a bar, go, you know, have lunch together or something. But I do get email from people. I now that I've gotten my platform up and running with my blog and my other social media, it makes it easier for people to find me. I am the only person on the planet with my name, so that helps. But one of a kind, oh yeah. I love it when people contact me, not because it's, you know, such an ego boost, but I love to, you know, get the contact from out there, because writing is such a lonely business most of the time, especially when they're teenagers or, you know, college students, people who are still in school. And they come up to me and they say, oh, I got so excited about this. Can you tell me where I can find this? And that's just a thrill because, of course, I'm a big supporter of literacy and of writers who are starting out of whatever age. So I really want to be there and help people because so many people have helped me.
That's amazing. That's a really good thing. I also am a huge supporter of literacy. I have always been. Even when I was a kid, remember when they used to have readathons to support literacy? I used to do that. I used to be one of the highest people in my class because I would read as many books as possible. And usually at that time they were mysteries. every Ellery Queen, Agatha Christie I could grab. I think I've read all of them now.
You know, during the summer when I was in grade school or junior high, they would have the readathon at the library. And sometimes you could win prizes. Well, I would go in there and I would look for the books that had either the skull and crossbones on the spine or the atomic symbol with a rocket, because that was either mystery or science fiction. And I'd, you know, come out with an armload of those and go back in the next week and get a bunch more. So I hear what you're saying. I mean,
yeah.
It's like, oh, what, they're going to pay me to do this? Yeah, let's party.
Yeah. Well, it's like it's your pleasure, and you're going to get, like, some kind of reward, because everybody got a reward in those days.
Yeah.
Just for taking part. So it was cool. But anyway, literacy is something I worry about, and also fiction is something that, it seems to me that unless it's popular, people, the kids, don't want to read it. Like, right now it's Percy Jackson. Before that it was Harry Potter. I would love for them to reach out and try stuff that they've never seen or read or other people aren't reading. I mean, I loved Harry Potter, and I love Percy Jackson. I think they're both really good series, very educational, very positive. But I'd like them to try to do something that's outside of that. How do you feel about that? You know, how they kind of tend to go to what's popular.
Well, whatever gets them reading is okay with me, for starters.
Well, yes, I agree with that. I agree, yeah.
Now,
but, I
know what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I didn't read the Harry Potter books for a long time because I thought, oh, young adult fiction, been there, done that. Because I was a reviewer for a long time, and most of what, I mean, my room looked like the back room at Barnes & Noble for a long time. And a lot of what I read was so bad. It just was. And I sort of had a bias against young adult fiction because, I mean, what I was hearing about Harry Potter sounded depressing, frankly. And when I finally got into the first book, the first two or three chapters just horrified me because of what poor Harry has to deal with going in. Of course, if you stick with it, you see why she starts from that point. And talk about reader sympathy, I mean, wow. The great thing about Harry Potter is that you can prevail. I mean, yeah, he's special. Yeah, he's the one. But still, if you hang in there, you will find the people you belong with. You'll find your tribe, which is a wonderful idea to put across to kids. The Percy Jackson books are great too, but he's a demigod, right? Once again,
right.
We have somebody with basically superpowers. I'd like to see more of the everyman or everywoman character, you know, the person who's not particularly gifted in the sense of, you know, supernatural gifts, but has to make it on his or her own survival skills, whatever he or she has developed because of the life that person has led. And doing it in a science fiction or a fantasy or even a horror context, I think would be beneficial to the readership, at least at that age, because, you know, they say in Hollywood, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. I think more emphasis might be put on characters that the kids can identify with instead of being wish fulfillment. I mean, maybe I'm being a wet blanket here, but it's hard to know the balance because both of my kids are special needs, right? So there are some things they are not going to be able to do. And reading Harry Potter, reading the Narnia books to them, or having them read now, is a happy thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, anything that's positive is good. Tell us a bit about what you're working on now.
I'm sorry?
Can you tell us a bit about what you're working on now?
Sure. The working title for the book is Swordmaster Flower Maiden. It's set in historical Japan. I have an English girl who came with her parents to Japan as part of the technology transfer when the shogun finally decided he better get with the program and try and start catching up with Western technology. Now, really, it's still the emperor at this point who's inviting people over. Anyway, one of the Englishmen is, and he's a minor diplomat. You don't even see him in the book, really. He's a gambler and he's a drinker, and he falls into the hands of an evil samurai who knows how vulnerable he is. The British man's wife dies, and he's left with this little girl. Well, the samurai says, gets him into a position through cheating on him, that he has such a horrendous debt built up, he can't pay it, and that could destroy his career and ruin him and all of that. So the samurai says, tell you what, why don't you let me have your daughter? I'll raise her, I'll give her a good education, you know, she'll be in a foreign land, she'll have all those advantages, and you can go home. Well, the father takes the deal. The book opens with Yuriko, that's her name, trying to escape. Because she's finally found out what the samurai is really going to do with her. He is going to, now that she's trained to be a perfect Japanese maiden, he's going to give her to a daimyo, one of the great powerful lords of Japan, as a bribe for political power. And this isn't going to be a fun life. So she runs away and runs right into one of the local run-in, a masterless samurai, busy chasing bandits out of his village. Well, the only thing the ronin can do is scoop her up onto his horse, or he's going to run right over her. So he ends up carrying her off. It's the only thing they can do. And he recognizes the livery on the guards who are with her and knows that they're from the evil samurai, who he also has reasons to hate. So they're thrown together, and they go hide out in the hunter's shack where Tendo's son lives, and it's what is called in the romance industry a forced marriage scenario. They're stuck together in this little one-room place, and they spend the next 3 weeks basically hiding out and getting to know each other with various bad guys trying to find them and various locals causing trouble as well. So it's a lot of fun because he's never seen a Western woman before, and he can't believe that she speaks Japanese perfectly. She is living every moment in fear of being captured, and they're pretty much stuck with each other, so the situation forces them to get to know each other, which is the whole point. And it's just, you know, they do fall in love because that's the point of the book. But I had a good time with all the, the cultural moments, because she really is Japanese in terms of culture.
Hmm.
So
that
it's not, yeah, it's not the impossible match some people might think.
That sounds like an interesting novel. Do you have any events coming up?
Yes, I will be at Convolution in Burlingame, September 26th, 27th, and 28th.
Okay. And may the listeners have your website.
It's www.lillian888.wordpress.com.
Okay. I'll also have that up on my website for everybody on both my blog and my website, either Friday or Saturday for everybody, so you can get in contact with Lillian and ask her any more questions. Thank you, Lillian. It was a very fast half hour, don't you think?
Yes, it was. Thank you so much, Sherry.
Thank you. On Thursday, we're going to have a special show with producer, screenwriter, and now author Stephen L. Sears, and the very well-known author, Peter J. Wax. They're going to talk about a novel that they did together called Villain, and it's really, well, I started reading it. It's really good. So please tune in for that, because it's going to be a lot of fun. I'd like my live audience to thank Lillian. Thank you, Lillian.
My pleasure.
And thank you for chatting with Sherry.